The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Mark A. Barnett presiding before Consolidated Court Number 19-122, Committee Overseeing Action of Lumber International Trade Investigation or Negotiation at All versus the United States. Will the attorney please state your name for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
And please take a seat as you do that.
Good morning. My name is Sophia Lin. I am here from the Cartel Row on behalf of the coalition.
Morning.
Good morning. Just to link on behalf of the coalition from Picard Kempton Row.
Good morning, Your Honor. With the staff from the United States, the Department of Justice, and with me is Jesus Stein from the Department of Commerce.
Good morning.
Ms. Alan Cashman from Vice Rome on behalf of the government of Canada.
Nancy Noonan from Aaron Fox Schiff on behalf of the government of Quebec.
John Magnus, Tradewinds, here for Mobilier Rustique.
Edward Lebo, Haynes and Boone for Marcel Lozon Duke and P&G Forest Products.
Ross Paul from Sidley Austin for North American Crosswinds.
Aaron Hutman from Booker Winthrop Shaw Pittman on behalf of the government of New Brunswick.
Stephen Becker from Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, also on behalf of the government of New Brunswick.
Mark Lennar from Office of David L. Simon on behalf of Funding.
Morning. Morning, everyone.
So, we issued questions about a week ago. The way I'd like to proceed today is to just to start by focusing on those questions in order to not spend the entire day and into the evening going through that process. Probably makes most sense to combine some of those questions as we go through. So I think, generally speaking, on the supplier subsidy section, it probably makes sense to ask you to take questions 1 through 3 all together, and then we can do maybe 4 and 5 together. And then when we get to the tax credit questions, I think we can do all 5 of those together probably, and do that in an orderly fashion. And I think the same with the tax benefit, the Fontaine tax year issue, do both of those questions together. We'll do each, when I talk about doing them together, we'll give whoever the moving party is for that issue, give a chance to address it first, and we'll go to the government, and then whoever else we have aligned with the government on that particular issue, a chance to speak, and back and forth. You'll have plenty of time to talk. Don't worry. You'll get your say. And then once we get through the questions, if any of you have any energy left and feel that there's anything that you haven't had a chance to address at that point, you'll have an opportunity to make those additional points at that time. Any questions about process? Any issues that we ought to take up up front? Nope. Okay. Let's just dive in then. Supplier subsidies, and we'll start with the coalition. Ms. Lin, you want to take questions 1 through 3 and their various subparts, et cetera? And probably, unless you're just saying I have nothing more to add or yes or no, like a one-sentence response, I will ask you to come up to the podium just for simplicity's sake and formality's sake, et cetera. But we do have microphones at the spread throughout the tables. So, okay. Ms. Lin. Can you pull the microphone down?
Better?
Yes.
Okay. So our answer for question 1 and 3 are actually the same. We don't believe that Congress has stated its position with regard to whether these respondents are producers or not. But because Commerce refused to apply the trading company regulation, it seems that Commerce took the position that these respondents are the producers. The statute requires Commerce to countervail all direct and indirect subsidies provided in the production of subject merchandise. So if Commerce's position is that respondents are producers, then Commerce must calculate the subsidy rate to account for subsidies provided to the lumber products these respondents purchased from third parties. If Commerce does not believe that these respondents are the producer, then Commerce must apply the trading company provision to account for the subsidy provided to these lumber products. Because the final results did not do either of these things, that's why we think the final result was unlawful and incorrect.
Okay.
So that's my answer to the first and two.
If you, we're going to adjust the mic. Does that cover really one through three?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some respects, this is more directed in the first instance to for the government to help me out here. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Speck. And let me say, I think as you're thinking about how to address these questions, for the government, I mean, you may want to feel free to take a step back, if you will, from the question. And I mean, this is one of those areas where it's not entirely clear. I think, you know, as you read through the IND memo, the agency is largely responding on each one of these issues to the arguments that were made by the coalition in their administrative case brief, as opposed to advancing an affirmative statement as to, okay, here's why we're doing what we're doing, and then let me respond to your arguments against what we're doing. It lacks that affirmative argument. And if there's something in the IND memo that I've missed somewhere else that you want to point me to that makes that affirmative statement before you get into the responsive part of it, feel free to point me there, because we're having, as you can tell by the questions probably, it's we're not finding a lot of clarity in the agency's explanation.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think there is an affirmative statement. I think Commerce thinks it's discernible from its position, which is addressed in the IND memo, that it considers the respondent remanufacturers to be producers of the subject merchandise exported to the United States. This is somewhat addressed at page 38 of the final memorandum. There are two types of products that were provided by unaffiliated suppliers to certain respondents. First, the law that the respondents used to manufacture lumber, and secondly, lumber that respondents further manufactured before exporting to the United States. And it's Commerce's position that in both cases, the respondents used products from the unaffiliated suppliers to produce the finished merchandise that was sold and exported to the United States as subject merchandise. And so,
part of the challenge here is we're taking probably at least three different issues and combining them all into one discussion and not being very clear with regard to any one of them. So, I mean, let's sort of break it down if we can a little bit. Logs, I don't think the coalition's challenging the decision with respect to logs, unless I missed something. I think it's focused on the lumber imports. With regard to the lumber imports, then you have two separate issues. One is purchases by these companies that are just directly resold. What happens with those? Second, what happens with regard to purchases of lumber that is qualifies as subject merchandise at the time it's purchased, is further manufactured in some respect, and then resold and exported to the United States? But those arguably are two separate questions, the direct resale without any further manufacture and the further manufacturing. Now, if I understood you correctly, what you said is, well, anytime they're doing any further manufacturing, we think the exporter is the producer. And let's focus on that issue in the first instance. What does that mean with regard to, for example, the agency's response where they say, well, but we don't have to worry about any of this stuff about making sure we get the right rates for the right people and so on, because you know, our instructions to customs, for example, are specific. You know, it's going to be only for stuff that is produced and exported by. So now you've got a remanufacturer here where, you know, they're buying the rough-hewn lumber and doing fairly limited further manufacturing to it. Okay, as I understand the government's position, well, that remanufacturer is now the producer, and it's what all the subsidies have disappeared, and presumably an arm's length transaction that was never examined by the department. I mean, where are we at here on that one?
Your Honor, I don't know if the court. It didn't presume that subsidies passed down to the ultimate respondent, as I explained in the decision memorandum. There is no explicit definition. I don't know if the court's looking more for a specific definition of where remanufacturing was defined, which it wasn't explicitly defined, but the final results did sort of describe the activities that were conducted by the respondent remanufacturers that would lead to the conclusion that they were, or a reasonable conclusion that they were producers of the remanufactured lumber. I don't know if that's what the court wants me to address that, or...
No, go ahead and start. Feel free to start there.
On page 38 of the issues and decision memorandum, Commerce stated that almost all the respondents in the expedited review either manufactured lumber from logs from unaffiliated suppliers or performed further manufacturing on lumber acquired from unaffiliated suppliers. So Commerce always, logs and lumber are inputs to the respondent's exports to the United States. So Commerce's position was that the remanufacturers, the respondents, used the lumber from the unaffiliated suppliers in the manufacture or production of the subject merchandise or otherwise used the input supplied by the unaffiliated company to produce subject merchandise and therefore acted as the producer of the merchandise.
Okay.
But to the extent the court was looking for an explicit definition, this goes somewhat to question number two. We would submit that Commerce described it, but if the court is looking for a more explicit definition, then certainly the government would request a remand to provide that explanation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to, and the third question in its subpart?
Did you want me to go back to part two of number one, the remanufacturers were not the producers?
Well, because I think you said they are the producers.
We think they are the producers. If for some reason the court disagrees.
Well, we'll have to get to the trading company issue in any case because there are some situations where they are just direct resellers, right?
And is the court referring to receipt?
Mm-hmm. Rustique is the further manufacturer. D&G is the one that's the pure reseller for some product.
To briefly respond to that part two of the question, if the court disagreed, Commerce would, we just wanted to point out, the court considered a respondent remanufacturer, a trading company, or a non-producing exporter of Commerce. As we explained in our brief and in the memorandum, it would still only have record information on subsidies received by the respondents and not the unaffiliated suppliers. And so Commerce would be unable to use the benefit calculation pursuant to 351.525C.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Certainly. No,
I mean, that's another part of the issue there.
And I'm sorry, do you want me to go ahead and turn to question number three?
Yes, please.
Okay. So assuming that in-scope merchandise is considered an input, so the statute directs Commerce to account for all countervailable subsidies provided with respect to the manufacture, production, or export of a class or kind of merchandise. And in this case, the lumber provided to the respondents by unaffiliated suppliers, our position was not itself the merchandise imported to the United States, and that it was remanufactured lumber processed by the respondents. So the lumber provided by the unaffiliated suppliers fits the statutory definition of an upstream input and that it is a product that is used in the manufacture or production of merchandise that is subject to the countervailing duty proceeding and was, because it was remanufactured, it reasonably constitutes an input under the language of the statute. The court, looking at the live swine from Canada case, we think it's both distinguishable and as well, I believe the Canadian parties addressed on page 36 of their brief, ECF 120. The Canadian Meat Council decision seems to reject Commerce's statement on the on how Commerce itself, the quotation from live swine from Canada that was included there. We also think it's factually distinguishable because in live swine from Canada, Commerce determined that because piglets and hogs were both subject merchandise, bear swine, the upstream subsidy provision was inapplicable to benefits provided to piglet producers. But in that case, piglets were not remanufactured or further processed in contrast to the lumber from unaffiliated suppliers that underwent further manufacturing in this case. And again, to the extent, to the statement the court cited, Canadian Meat Council 661 Federal Supplement, I can get the site in a moment, 622, pages 625 and 626. Which was addressed in the Canadian Party's brief, also seems to review the statement. In terms of legislative history, the court noted, we noted that it looked like the portion of the court citing the House bill, which was subsequently modified in the conference report. We also would note that at page 120, the conference report, House Report 98-1156, at 170, seems to discuss this not in terms of input, but discusses the term that has never, quote, been explicitly defined to include or exclude subsidies. This goes at prior stages of the manufacturing or production process. And so we interpreted this to mean that the provision is not specifically discussing input, but other stages of the manufacturing process.
Okay. Yeah, we'll get to 4 and 5, I think. Okay. Who wants to start? Anyone? Anyone over there? Add anything?
Edward Lebo on behalf of DAG. The questions are essentially addressed to the government and not to us. All we would say is that the record, and the confidential record as well, shows very clearly that our clients did not benefit from subsidized prices when they acquired any of these inputs. And also in the case of Hortbeck, the related company to DEG, the exports to the United States of further reprocessed split lumber were minuscule.
John Magnus from Obelia Rustic. I will have a word when we get to question 5, but very little more than a word on that subject. Okay.
And Ms. Lynn, you want to respond to what the government had to say? Or?
Sure. I'll just come up.
Please.
So with regard to our challenge here, we...
Could you pull the microphone down towards you a little bit better?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, this is working. I want to clarify that our challenge is with respect to lumber products, not lumber that the respondents purchased from third-party producers. We're not talking about logs here. So I just want to clarify that. In terms of the subsidy provided to these lumber products, Commerce's preamble at 62 Fed Reg 27303 made clear that subsidy provided to subject merchandise benefited subject merchandise, so no pass-through analysis is required, regardless of whether that those subsidies are provided to the producers or to the exporters. That's why Commerce accumulates when there's a trading company. In terms of the definition of input,
but in the trading company scenario, I mean, it specifies that it's when the trading company doesn't do any further manufacturing. I mean, this is a little unusual.
Right, but that is correct. But the preamble specifically said that when you're talking about subject merchandise, all subsidy provided to the subject merchandise is about what is provided to the subject merchandise, not about how many parties have passed. It went through in terms of the process. And I think the court's question goes to the definition of an input product. Commerce's position, if I understand it, is that because the lumber product never actually came to the United States, it went to the respondent's company, and then there was some minuscule, very little further manufacturing, such as, you know, cutting them in half, that comes to the United States. Those lumber would not consider subject merchandise because they were not exported. We think if that's the definition, then it actually distinguishes the difference between an input product and a subject merchandise. And by that definition, if a subject merchandise, something that would have been a subject merchandise, has been cut in half, then it's always an input product. And we don't think that's actually the meaning of the statute or the legislative history. We also want to point to Del Verde 1, and I think we have a citation.
Right, that's in your brief.
In our reply brief, 989 F-Sub 218. In Del Verde, the court also confirmed this court's questions an interpretation of an input product, which is that a subject merchandise may be upstream to the subject merchandise that is ultimately exported, but they are still considered subject merchandise and not an input product, and therefore no upstream subsidy allegation is required. With respect to the Canadian party's arguments about small amounts, how these products are very small, I don't know if the court, I know that there's a separate question on that, and I can address that later, or I can address it now.
Well, do you have anything to say on, anything further you want to say on questions 1 through 3?
I think that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unless anybody else wants to add anything at this point, okay, then why don't you roll right into the 4, and feel free to take on 5 as well.
Sure. So in terms of the argument that it's very, the amount is very small, I will give you the statute at 1671A1 that says that commerce has the obligation to countervail subsidies that's provided directly or indirectly to the production of subject merchandise. There's no de minimis exception there. So commerce has an obligation to calculate it regardless of whether it's very small or not.
Anything additional that you wanted to say on 5 with regard to combination rates?
Our position is that if commerce doesn't believe that these companies are the producers, then they must apply the trading company provision, and it makes there's no distinction between whether this obligation applies regardless of whether these companies are de minimis or not de minimis when commerce did the calculation without accounting for the subsidy provided to the lumber products they repurchase. And I just wanted to like to point out, some of this information is BPI, so I won't specifically name the companies, but on commerce's argument that they cannot calculate these subsidies because they didn't individually examine the producer. In one instance, some of the lumber that they purchased actually came from a company that was individually examined in the investigation. So Commerce has an accurate subsidy rate for that, and there's no reason why Commerce shouldn't apply the combination rate provision. And on the questions of whether Commerce needs to actually individually examine the producers in order to apply a combination rate, we don't believe that's necessary. In our brief, we pointed out that Commerce can apply the all others rate for the producer rate because the POI is the, or POI or POR is the same as the investigation.
Really, what distinguishes this case from probably any other where they had to deal with a situation like this, right? Because, I mean, only in a situation where you're dealing with an expedited review, because you've got the period of review that's identical to the POI, arguably everybody has a rate at that point.
Right, and the statute allows, not only allows, actually requires Commerce to apply the all others rate to producers that were not individually examined. So if these producers, if they're exporting themselves, get the all others rate, we don't think there's a reason why Commerce can also apply the all others rate when they're dealing with the combination rate context.
Okay. All right, thank you. Respect.
Note in the middle of my response. Appreciate the court's patience. We are at court. I'm sorry. Which questions are we?
4 and 5.
In terms of the question, I believe was about where, with the basis for Commerce's determination. I guess we understood the question related more to the regulation, which was 351.525C. And just had wanted to point out that the preamble essentially stated that it's 63 Federal Register, 65, 348, 65, 404, that this regulation at 351.525C was just basically a codification of Commerce's existing practice, and as Commerce explained in its issues and decision memorandum, it generally had a practice of not, I guess, sort of further explaining on its practice, not addressing these determinations, not applying these regulations in small amounts. And just sort of the issue really is for Commerce, one of administrability and one of the fact that it's treating each.
How am I supposed to interpret this? Because it seems like there are, I don't know, a handful of different explanations and responses that Commerce gives. I mean, are they cumulative? Are they in the alternative? I mean, because one of the problems, for example, in the trading company, I mean, it's part of why it's difficult to understand is because some of the reasoning is a bit circular. On the one hand, they say, well, we can't do the trading company type analysis because we don't have a rate for the supplier. And then in response to arguments, well, you should use the all others rate, say, well, we're not going to address the all others rate argument because we've already decided that we don't apply the trading company regulation. Doesn't seem to be responsive to the arguments. I mean, it seems to dance around and be circular.
Well, you're
got anything?
Unfortunately, on this question, don't have a lot more to give you to work with on that. We have, again, just turning back to regulation.
I mean, do you agree that this is different than, I mean, most of the scenarios, to the extent that Commerce has gone and said, well, we really, in order to look at and apply some kind of a rate in a trading company scenario, combination rate or aggregated rate, that we have to have a rate for the supplier, okay? And if we don't have a rate for the supplier, we can't investigate the supplier, then we can't do it. Understood. But this is as I mentioned with Ms. Lynn, I mean, this is a little different scenario here because we're dealing with an expedited review where the period of review is identical to the period of investigation. So arguably, as a result of the investigation, for every producer in Canada, there is a rate. Either it's an individual rate or it is the all others rate. It has been established. I mean, in a normal, say, in an investigation, for example, you couldn't try to apply that logic because it would be circular in and of itself because the all others rate would depend upon the results of the investigation, and the results of the investigation would depend on the application of an all others rate to the supplier. So it doesn't work. But here, why doesn't it work?
Follow what Commerce's general practice is, because it's helpful to the court, it may not be. Generally, Commerce's practice in countervailing duty proceedings where a trading company is selected as a mandatory respondent is to establish one deposit rate for the trading company for all its subject merchandise exports, regardless of the producer. So I think that the Commerce generally, I guess, doesn't apply the combination rate, even when the trading company is usually selected as a mandatory respondent. And was there another?
On five, anything you want? Well, yeah, I don't know if there's anything you want to add on five or.
So this was about specifically receipt, that was number five. If the court were to determine that receipt is a non-producing export or trading company, the trading company regulations would, of course, apply. In that case, Commerce, again, we've been through this discussion, would only have record information. We submit that it would not be able to perform a benefit calculation because it didn't have record information on the unaffiliated suppliers. But Commerce, that was the answer was there. Again, even where we review trading companies, its practice is to calculate one rate for the trading company, which is inclusive of subsidies provided to all of the trading company suppliers, and not to apply a combination rate in those circumstances. And then to establish one deposit rate for the trading company for all of its subject merchandise exports, regardless of the producer.
Okay. Thank you.
In the hope that will help the court. And these points are practical ones, but I do believe that they help to explain why Commerce landed where it did. The relevant inputs in the case of Mobilia received were rough-hewn lumber inputs. I personally don't know. I don't think the record reveals whether at the moment that these rough-hewn lumber inputs were purchased, whether they were subject merchandise already or not. Could have been. What the record does show is that they accounted for a tiny portion of what Mobilia received process. Mobilia received is a producing exporter, not a non-producing exporter. And these Russian lumber inputs accounted for a tiny, tiny portion. And through commingling, became invisible. And so there would be literally no way to identify some subset of Mobilia received exports to the United States that could have been singled out for distinctive treatment through some sort of a combination rate or something like that. Even if Commerce had tried to develop a factual record to help it do that, that would never have worked. So the only conceivable way to account for subsidies to the rough-hewn lumber inputs would be to assume that they somehow, that they passed through some arbitrary portion of the subsidy with an arm's length sale. There's a lot of mess there. But we agree with the arguments from the Canadian government about why that would be unlawful. But also, it would make no difference at all, fairly even a rounding error in the case of the speaks result from the expedited review. So the juice, as far as we can see, is not and wouldn't have been worth the squeeze in any case. Just note, if somebody were going to attempt a calculation like the one I just described, that would be necessary to take account of the fact that in Rusty's case, almost all of the rough, the tiny amount of rough lumber that Rusty bought was bought from one of the individually investigated companies from the original investigation, which itself had a subsidy calculation well below the all others rate. And so they didn't have much to pass through in the first place. And that's one of several reasons why you could go through an awful lot of mathematical work on this, and you wouldn't, even with a magnifying glass, be able to see how it affects Mobilia Mystique's numerical result. Hopefully that's helpful to the court.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll be voting for D&G. Just to support what Mr. Magnus has just said and what the government has said, the share of D&G exports represented by the tiny amount of remanufactured merchandise handled by Portbeck was so minuscule it would have no impact on the margin, and therefore it made little sense for the government to go through the amount of complication and time it would take to try to calculate a combined combination rate.
Yep. Going to the property tax assessment program.
Sorry, can I respond to it?
Please. Sure.
Okay. So on Rustique's point, well, sorry, first of all, on the government's point about,
they don't seem to be picking up.
Okay, sorry. For government's argument that usually establish one rate for the trading company, there were circumstances where Commerce did establish a combination rate for trading companies. We don't see, like I said, we don't see why this case is different. If Commerce decides to apply one rate to the trading company,
you haven't made any arguments against the factual finding that Commerce makes and that the Canadian parties advance, and that is that, you know, at the end of the day, the amount of product that we're talking about, the product that is further manufactured by either of these companies, is so small that it, you know, is probably not impactful upon the final result.
Right. That may be true, but I think that's a question on remand. Commerce didn't even go through the calculation to figure out how small it is. And as we pointed out, for one of the...
To say that they have to go through the calculation to determine if they have to go through the calculation or not isn't exactly a helpful response. I mean, the question is what is your argument in response to the claim, the statement that it's not worth it in this particular case, or in these two particular cases?
I guess there's a legal response and there's a factual response. The legal response is the statute never says that because it's so, the statute doesn't have a de minimis exception. The statute says you have to countervail all known direct and indirect subsidy provided to subject merchandise. So that's why we think Commerce needs to go through the calculation and then calculate rate, add them up. If it's still de minimis, it's still de minimis. But Commerce didn't go through that exercise. On the factual question, for one of, sorry, I can't remember if this is BPI, but we in our reply brief, our opening brief, we talked about whether the amount is small, and we believe that for one of these companies, the amount is actually not small. It's the entirety of that company's business. So we don't think this amount is considered small. On Rustique's argument about how there is no record evidence on whether some of these products that they purchased from third parties were actually subject merchandise, there actually is record evidence for that. I don't believe it's submitted in the administrative record, but in tab 11 of Rustique's questionnaire response, it referenced this Exhibit B, and we're happy to put this on the record for the court after this oral argument. Exhibit B, I think that exhibit is entirely BPI, but that did indicate that would answer the court's question on whether these products are subject merchandise or not. So that's it.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to go ahead and by the end of the week, if you could file that,
yeah,
that'd be appreciated. Anything further from anyone on the supplier subsidies issues? No. Okay.
Okay. On the
exhaustion.
Yes, my favorite topic. On exhaustion. So we believe that we did exhaust. We were satisfied with the preliminary results.
That's doesn't get you exhaustion.
Yes. So
exhaustion involves responding to the argument that, I mean, here's the problem.
Yeah.
They did something you didn't want.
Right.
Or they did something in the prelim. Okay. New Brunswick comes in, says, hey, no, you ought to make this adjustment to it. Okay. You have a chance to respond to that in your rebuttal brief to the agency.
Right.
They say, not only, you should adjust it, and here are a couple of different ways that you should think about adjusting it. Do this, or in the alternative to that, do that.
Mm-hmm.
Exhaustion means in your rebuttal brief, you've got to respond to those arguments, because the whole point of them making the argument is so that the agency can decide in the first instance, with the benefit of all the arguments before it, what are we going to do in the final?
Right.
Now, explain to me how you responded to where you responded to the argument of using the, I'm going to mess up the name, was it Higgins and Cunningham? It sounds like something out of Harry Potter. how you responded to using that as a way, in the ratio derived from that to adjust for the land assessment.
Right. No, I understand the question. So the respondents made a lot of arguments in their case brief. For example, NFP's case brief on the sole issue of benefit calculation was 9 pages long, and that's not including their arguments on financial contribution and specificity. They argue a lot of things. They argue that there's no revenue forgone, that timberlands were worth more than $100 per hectare, so there's no benefit conferred, that if Commerce were really going to use a benchmark, it should remove the value of trees. And then they have one paragraph about this ratio question about how Commerce could use a ratio to remove the value of trees. And then their specific argument about using the Higgins case for the ratio was altogether one sentence. And this was on page 31 of their case brief. So we responded to all of these arguments. We don't know which way Commerce was going to go. Again, we were satisfied with the preliminary results, but we responded to all of these arguments raised by NFP. We said that Commerce's benefit calculation was proper, and that we also have a bunch of arguments about how Commerce should not remove the value of trees from the benchmark. And then we said that if Commerce really were to remove the value of trees, there's no reasonable or objective way to do so. So that's on page 39 of our rebuttal brief.
How is that making the argument as to what your concerns are with the Higgins ratio?
Right, so our concern with the Higgins ratio is that it's very fact-specific. It's based on the particular facts of that case. That's why in our rebuttal brief, we said that there was no reasonable or objective way to actually calculate how you remove the value of trees. And the exhaustion requirement, the court in Calcutta Seafood has said that it is enough if the record contains a suggestion of an argument. The Fed Circuit in Apex Frozen Foods also analyzed the question of exhaustion in the light of whether the party gave Commerce a meaningful opportunity to address the issue. And so when we said that we don't think there is a reasonable or objective way to remove the value of trees, we think that we have provided Commerce a opportunity to address the issue. In the final results, all Commerce said about using the ratio, which also was a 180-degree change from their preliminary results, and all they said about why they're using the ratio is that first, it is that case, the Higgins case, was done prior to the POR, which we know is 10 years before the POR. And then two, it concerns New Brunswick property. We don't think that's anywhere near explaining why using the Higgins case, the ratio developed in the particular facts of the Higgins case was a reasonable or objective way to actually remove the value, what's the value of trees in our particular instance. Thank you.
Ms. Speck, do you want to respond at all?
Your Honor, I don't have very much. We simply think that Boomerang 2, as we cited in our brief, supports our position that just because there was a change from the preliminary to the final doesn't mean they didn't have an opportunity to bring it up, as the parties have shown in their briefing. Certainly the Higgins and Tutenbaum was raised below, and they had an opportunity to raise the objections. And just as the party failed to do in Boomerang Tube, they are barred. They failed to exhaust, and they should not be addressed further by the court.
May it please the court, perhaps I can offer a little bit of clarity. There's a lot of confusing bits of fact, I think, that have presented from the case below. We agree entirely with Your Honor here today. We agree with Your Honor's reasoning in Unicatch. The facts that are specific here are that before the preliminary determination, putting aside that there were very long briefs that we're all required to read and respond to, before the preliminary determination, petitioner is the one who put Higgins and Tudenham on the record. NAFP then responded to that placement on the record by arguing the point about ratios and the ratios that might have come from this case in looking at property taxes. This is all fully vetted and discussed beforehand. Also beforehand, petitioner had put information on the record that were a series of cherry-picked cases that it said this should be the benchmark. These are the two points that petitioners then argued before the CIT. After this pre-prelim back and forth, we come to the case briefs. In the case briefs, petitioner didn't bring up these arguments. It also had a second bite of the apple on rebuttal because NAFP did bring up these arguments. It didn't respond. It didn't bring up Higgins. It didn't bring up this $375 case point. It's interesting that Ms. Lynn says that this case is very fact-specific. Well, before the CIT, what she argued was that this $375 figure, which is one particular property value from 1990s, should be used by Commerce Department as a benchmark, a new benchmark, again, which was not argued in the underlying case. These cherry-picked set of cases that I mentioned that have been brought up in the prelim, the government of Brunswick addressed those. Coalition then dropped this argument and didn't bring it up in the case brief or the rebuttal brief, but then resuscitated or is attempting to resuscitate it before the CIT. So really, this is the factual background. This wasn't something that was snuck in case briefs, and then, you know, this is one of these exceptions where nobody could possibly have been able to catch it. This was well vetted, fully briefed. And I think that we, again, defer to your Honor's reasoning in the Unicatch case, which we think is appropriate here.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hudson, right? Okay. Sorry. Oh, okay. Sorry, this is my clock. It was Mr. Hutman, right?
I apologize. I was just pointed out that I missed the key step, Aaron Hutton, for the government of Brunswick.
Thank you. Just for the transcript.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Anything further in reply, Ms. Lynn?
Sure. On the government's argument, we're mentioning of Boomerang, I would say that Boomerang, the facts were that the domestic party did not respond at all to the arguments made by the respondents, and the Fed Circuit said that you have to respond somehow. And like I said, we believe that we did respond in our rebuttal brief in terms of this suggestion, this one-sentence suggestion of using the ratio. And also in Apex Frozen Food, which was decided 2 months after Boomerang, the Fed Circuit analyzed the question of exhaustion in light of whether Commerce was given opportunity to address the argument. And we believe that in this case, we did give Commerce an opportunity to address it. On the argument of whether there is whether we're suggesting that Commerce should have used a direct comparison approach, this $375 per hectare, or other types of approach, I would just want to clarify that our argument in this case is we're questioning whether Commerce's selection of this ratio was a reasonable approach, and we don't believe that Commerce has provided explanation as to why this is reasonable. And we provided various different alternative benchmarks on the record to show that Commerce has not provided explanation of why.
The question is, you didn't make the arguments as to why using the Higgins case would not be reasonable. You had a very generic statement as opposed to an argument. I mean, the argument as to why it's reasonable is because it gives us a way of taking out the value of the timber,
right?
In terms of the assessed value. So, I mean, the arguments about why that's not a reasonable approach needed to have been made in the first instance to the agency. That's where I'm struggling to understand your argument as to how you exhausted.
Yeah. Well, so. I would again point out that there was a lot of suggestions prior to the prelim as to how Commerce could evaluate to establish the benchmark. There was a lot of arguments, and
is that an excuse for not making a specific argument? I mean, I don't know that there's some exception to the exhaustion doctrine that says, if there's more than X number of arguments, you're off the hook for responding to any one of them.
No, I mean, I think that I just bring out that fact that there was a lot of different suggestions as to how to do this. And in the prelim, we're happy with the prelim results. The respondents, the New Brunswick parties, provided a bunch of different arguments as to how you should do it. And then we responded to each one of them. I understand the court's questioning in terms of why we didn't the fact that we didn't elaborate further on why this is not reasonable. I acknowledge that we did not elaborate further, but our point is that we don't believe this is a standard for exhaustion. I think the standard is we bring up a suggestion. There's a suggestion of argument. Commerce has a responsibility to provide an explanation of why what they chose was reasonable. In light of all the different alternatives that's on the record. And we don't believe that Commerce has probably done that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's move on to the tax credit questions. I think we can take all five of them together in the first instance. And you want to, Mr. Magnus, you want to start?
Thank you. May it please the Court. John Magnus from Mobilier Rustique. I gather I'm going to be followed here by counsel for the Government of Quebec and the Government of Canada. So our presentation on this will hopefully be a coherent whole. grateful to have a day in court on this issue appreciative of the court's questions. The first one is about the timeline, the timeline strongly supports our position in this appeal. At the time that the Quebec logging tax and PLTC were put in place, the FLTC was already there and had been for 3 years. So the FLTC 1961, the Quebec measures simultaneously 1964. So at the time the FLTC was put in place,
can you point me to where in the record, if there's anything in the record that supports it? Because my recollection is that there is some information in the record that speaks to the debate in Parliament about adopting, I think, probably just the FLTC, which seems to suggest fairly clearly, and this was the basis for the question, that the tax was in place prior to the tax credit.
For the most part, I'm going to defer to government counsel on this, tax that was already in effect was not in the province of Quebec at that moment in time. May have been in some other province. The Quebec one did not exist at that point in time.
Okay.
And the Quebec measure, when it was put into place, was put into place under circumstances where it would have been clear and obvious that no taxpayer would actually bear any surtaxation on any portion of its income. The FLTC being already in place and having been in place for 3 years, and the Quebec provincial credit covering the last third being put in place simultaneously with the logging tax itself. So from the very, very birth of this thing, there was no possibility that any taxpayer would actually experience any surtaxation on any portion of its income.
Okay, but let me come back then to the question of, can you point me to where those facts are established in the record?
If I may, I'm going to...
Specific to Quebec.
Yes. Okay. If we can leave that question hanging until the government... Lawyer, okay. Government counsel, stand up.
Okay. Because the only facts that I was aware of, I've already made reference to, in terms of what was provided, at least to the court, as part of the administrative record, in terms, going back to the establishment of these.
The Government of Canada's exhibit about the debate, and it referred to circumstances about taxes. Logging taxes that might be put in place in the future. And what the FLTC did, at least insofar as Quebec is concerned, the FLTC created an environment where Quebec could then later come along and legislate secure in the knowledge that no taxpayer would actually experience any surtaxation.
Okay.
What that means in respect of our appeal is that it clarifies very nicely what is the normative benchmark in Canada and in Quebec with respect to surtaxation. The normative benchmark is consistent taxation across economic sectors with no tolerance of double taxation or of surtaxation. So when the court tries to identify, as it must do, that normative benchmark in order to determine whether the revenue here was otherwise due, the normative benchmark couldn't be any clearer. As far as applying the statutory requirement for a financial contribution, we think it's exactly that simple. The court has a question about whether the measures here stand or fall together. Of course, there would be no meaning for a PLTC or an FLTC if there were not a logging tax, as well. They exist to restore a situation for the taxpayer that exists because of the tax. So they would not operate, they would have no effect. So of course, to that degree they operate together. Legally speaking, again, I'm going to have to defer to the counsel for the government about whether the norm in Canada with respect to surtaxation or double taxation is a policy preference or a legal norm. But there's no doubt at all that it's a norm. And again, for the purpose of applying the revenue otherwise due part of the statute and figuring out what the normative benchmark is, it doesn't make any difference whether that is a legal requirement or a policy preference. It's a norm. The U.S. government itself, as we pointed out in our briefs, has been very clear that that's what otherwise due requires a decision maker to look at. This court's and Your Honor's own decision...
Haven't exactly been terribly successful at that, have they?
Beg to differ. That standard was, at least that argument, was embraced. And then turned around and applied to the U.S. measure that was being examined, and it was found faulting. The legal standard was accepted exactly as put forward by the United States government in that matter. This is in the WTO dispute. So as applied to those facts in that situation, it didn't perhaps get the United States the outcome that the United States was looking for. But it still sits as the
North Star for applying this language about when revenue is otherwise due. Revenue that a government theoretically could collect is otherwise due or not, just as in the Korean case with the emissions testing that this court decided a short while ago. As for question three, whether it is a fact that this measure enriches the provincial governments who use it. Whether that was the intended outcome, we're not sure that the record is super clear on that. But even in the 1960s, one can assume that legislators had some awareness of the economic substance of what they were doing. The economic substance of what they were doing was putting in place a measure that causes some portion of logging income to be transferred from the federal treasury to the provincial treasury every single year, and nothing else. And so if the court itself in deciding this appeal wants to focus on the economic substance, we think it will be on very, very strong ground. In other words, whether or not it appears that that's what was intended or whether that outcome has been openly acknowledged, we don't think the court needs to be concerned about that. And the court can make its decision based on the obvious economic substance of what's happening here. In respect of taxpayers like Rustique, there's no double taxation. There was never any possibility of double taxation. And the 10%, we have in our briefs referred to it as a phantom surtax, and we believe it's exactly that. It is not a burden that was ever expected to be borne by any taxpayer, and it is instead the beard, if you will, for an annual transfer from one government in Canada to another government in Canada. And Commerce isn't allowed to countervail based on something like that.
Well, maybe you want to turn to question four then. I mean, help me understand. I mean, that is one of the unusual aspects of this issue, is that we're talking about, let's say we accept the premise that should lump really all three things together, the FLTC, the PLTC, and the tax,
mm-hmm.
that it's across two different government entities.
Yes, it is across two different government entities. Neither one of which, well, it's most abundantly clear in the case of the PLTC. I mean, to say that the government of Quebec is foregoing revenue in this circumstance is preposterous. The government of Quebec is not foregoing anything. The government of Quebec is enriched by this whole scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no revenue foregone, and therefore not even the theoretical possibility of a benefit to a company like Mobilier Rustique. For the FLTC, and for the government of Canada, it's a little different. The federal government is receiving less than the 15% of income amount ordinarily what it would be expected to receive as the regular federal income tax. But every penny of that shortfall winds up in the treasury of the government of Quebec. None of it benefits or lands with Rustique or any other corporate taxpayer. So in that case, it's unlawful to find that there's a benefit to any taxpayer. So we think that where the statutory requirements are so clearly not...
The federal government did not have any kind of an obligation to the government of Quebec. I mean, to the extent that, for example, you're trying to rely on the Sri Lanka case, for example, I mean, that's one where, it passed through the rubber purchasers, I guess,
mm-hmm.
but that's because the government had an obligation to the rubber producers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just a means of getting, of satisfying the government's debt to the producers at the end of the day. Here we're talking about it's not an obligation that the federal government has to the provincial government. It's except to the extent that they, you know, through this convoluted tax program, they've decided they're going to funnel money to the province. I'm having a little tougher of a time seeing the analogy there.
Respectfully, that factual difference from the facts of the Sri Lanka case doesn't take this case outside the legal rationale of that one. But regardless of whether the federal government in this case has a legal obligation running to the provincial government, the fact is that any money that the federal government doesn't receive in relation to the 15% norm, we know where it winds up. Whether that is in satisfaction of a legal obligation or whether it's not, we still know where it winds up. We know exactly where it winds up. It winds up in the treasury of the provincial government. And none of it winds up with a taxpayer. And every taxpayer pays at the normal rate, 15% federal, 11% provincial, 26%. Whether you have logging income or whether you don't, you pay the normal tax rate. And so if revenue foregone analysis and benefit analysis are keyed to some benchmark, we submit that has to be the benchmark. The normal tax rate has to be the benchmark. And surtaxation, the avoidance of surtaxation is not some sort of a special benefit. It's the avoidance of a special penalty. Whether or not under Commerce's definition of a program, whether these are three programs or one program, we think is not dispositive of anything. Programs are a concept that Commerce uses to organize its work when it's carrying out a CVD investigation. The concept of a program doesn't appear much in the statute. It's in a couple of definitions in 1677. In a case where there clearly either is no revenue foregone, no financial contribution, as is true of the PLTC, or no benefit, as is true here for the FLTC, then, you know, if you are applying the concept of a program in a way that would somehow override those statutory requirements, then you're doing something unlawful. If it pleases the court, I'll give way to counsel for the two governments.
May it please the court, Alan Cashdan for the Government of Canada. Let me first endorse everything that Counsel for Rustique said. So in response to the questions, I'll go through them and add what I have to add. You were correct in your first question that with respect to province of British Columbia and Ontario, their logging taxes predated the FLTC. But as Mr. Magnus explained, Quebec came along after. And it may help to understand another aspect of the way this worked. The legislative history that you referred to in our exhibit from the minister's presentation to Parliament referred to something called the tax rental agreements. What that meant was at that time, Government of Canada collected taxes on behalf of the provinces and the federal government, and at the end of the year, through some mechanism, gave part of it back to the province. So when you've got this coming along, the federal government would have had to give more back to the provinces in order to effect the two-thirds logging tax credit. Quebec may have been in a different situation. I don't know what they had back then, but currently Quebec collects its own taxes, so it's different than BC and Ontario. Ontario no longer has a logging tax credit. Anyway, we don't think that the sequencing is relevant here. What's important is that the government of Canada had a policy against double taxation and implemented the FLTC 60 years ago to address that.
You said, you mentioned there for a second, that Ontario no longer has the provincial tax.
Lodging tax. They don't have the lodging tax.
The tax. Okay.
Right now it's only BC and Quebec.
Okay.
Standing or falling together, we agree with what Mr. Magnus said. It would make any sense to have the credits if the underlying tax didn't exist. In terms of whether it's based on...
What about the other way around?
Well, if you had the, let's see, if you had the credit, if you had the tax could
credit.
Exist without the credits, except for the policy, and you're against it. Now, you'd ask in your question whether that was policy or statutory. First, with respect to the FLTC itself, there is a statutory provision, which is in our questionnaire response, that provides for the FLTC. So that's statutory evidence there. More generally, and this was not in the record because it wasn't relevant at the time when we prepared our responses, but there is a provision in Canada's tax code, statutory provision, that provides that there shall not be double taxation. We can put that in the record if you'd like, but it is out there as a statutory provision against double taxation. Did the record contain evidence demonstrating that a transfer of wealth was the purpose from the government to the federal government to the provincial government? I have to say no, that is not likely the purpose. The clear purpose, though, is to avoid double taxation. And given the mechanism I described before of the federal government collecting tax and then paying part of it back to the province at the end of the year, the provincial share, the federal government must necessarily have known that there would, as a result of the credits, result in more money going back to then BC and Ontario. Question four, we're also not aware of any other specific determinations that Commerce has made that have two governments involved in a situation like this. But as Mr. Magnus said, we don't see that there's any difference there, really, between the Sri Lankan case and the Hyundai case, because looking at it in one way, you've got one government providing something of benefit, a financial benefit, to, in those cases, a private party, here to another government with a private company in between. But here, as in those cases, private government didn't get to keep any of it. The benefit all went to the other government. The fact that it's two governments involved doesn't seem to us to be relevant at all to the analysis.
Well, I mean, I come back to, I think where it is the distinction between, especially the clearest distinction with the Sri Lanka case, in that, the federal government is deciding to cover part of the company's obligations in terms of the logging tax to the province. Okay? It's not the government satisfying its own debt and using the federal government satisfying its own debt and simply washing that money through the lumber companies, but it's helping them offset their separate obligation to a distinct government entity. I'm having a hard time understanding why that's not a financial contribution that provides a benefit.
Well, we don't disagree that for the federal logging tax, because the federal government does collect less revenue than it would have otherwise collected. So there isn't revenue foregone by the federal government, but the benefit goes to the province of Quebec. And in that respect, both...
In the absence of that credit, the companies are on the hook for the tax, for the logging tax, right?
Absent the credit, but the credit and the tax and the credit do exist together. When the federal government introduced the federal logging tax, it anticipated and expected and hoped that the provinces would do the same because it's all part of a single package. If you look at this,
but why is it any different then? Any time a government provides a tax credit, the tax credit is provided on the basis that the recipient of that tax credit has undertaken some activity to become entitled to it. And so, obviously, those two things are connected together, but that's, in countervailing duty law, that we don't connect all those, the obligation and the decision, a separate decision by the government to relieve a taxpayer of the impact of that obligation.
Well, that's where we think the what is the program is key, because the tax regulation says that the benefit of the program of tax of revenue foregone less tax paid will be the benefit that's measured under the regulation. But if the program is all three together, as we are believe it is, and also in the Hyundai case, the court recognized that you could have multiple measures, multiple actors acting together to constitute a single program for analysis under the CPD law. And we don't think this case is any different.
Okay.
And then I guess getting to the fifth question, we agree, as Mr. Magnus argued, that there's the benefit prong of the statute is not met. Specifically in terms of other instances in the record where we think Commerce did not fairly address facts, we think there are at least four. Commerce noted the existence of the facts, but then failed to address them in a substantive or meaningful way. The first is Commerce acknowledged in page 46 of the IDM that Quebec's policy that the credits and the tax operate together in furtherance of Canada's and Quebec's policy against double taxation. Commerce acknowledged that. But then it said, the mere occurrence of double taxation and the Canadian government's decision to eliminate it does not render the FLTC and PLTC not countervailable. But that ignores that the whole structure of these three, they are meant to operate together. Benefit only goes to the government of Quebec. Second, at the IDM, pages 48 and 49, Commerce says that any arrangements between the GOC and GOQ regarding the proportion of the lodging tax to be credited by the federal provincial governments and the purposes of such an arrangement is beyond the purview of what Commerce is able to consider under the Act and its regulations. But they never explain why that's beyond its purview, why it cannot consider this fact, and the fact that the ultimate recipient here is another government rather than a private party like in Sri Lanka, which we just don't think is relevant. The third point Commerce acknowledged at page 48 is that unlike in Sri Lanka, in Inland Steel, there was no cash actually funneled from the federal government to the party to the respondent. It went through the tax mechanism. It didn't actually go through the private company's pockets. But again, then no actual cash passed hand doesn't seem to us be relevant. The fact is that the benefit went to the government of Quebec, not to Restique. And last, turning to the point of if you were to find, if we think you shouldn't, that there was a financial contribution and benefit, the net subsidy provision of 1677-6 says that Commerce can deduct from the subsidy any application, fee, deposit, or similar payment that must be made to get the tax benefit or the subsidy. Commerce simply says that a similar payment, we don't interpret it that way. We interpret it narrowly to cover the exact kind of situations, application fees or deposits that are already mentioned. They gave no independent context to what is
it. Just going back to my prior question, wouldn't that essentially swallow the whole concept of being able to countervail tax, any kind of tax credit program? Because again, presumably a tax credit is premised upon the recipient of the credit undertaking the underlying obligation.
But it wouldn't necessarily be to the government. For example, we have a tax credit, which I think was in this case, but probably isn't on appeal, involving scientific research and experimental development. That is a tax credit. It's no obligation to the government that's being set. You incur this expense, you get a credit for it. Here, the credit is only going as part of the mechanism to absolve the company of having double taxation, where the benefit goes to the other province.
Right, but presumably in your science example, there's an obligation to those who are performing conducting the research, let's say, you know, if that's what it might
but
be.
But the government doesn't impose the obligation in the first
place. Right, but it's a separate government. I mean, that's...
No government says you must conduct scientific research, mm-hmm. and we're going to give you a credit for it.
Understand. Let me actually, before you sit down, let me just ask one other question. I should have gone back and double checked. I mean, this is not our first rodeo with regard to lumber. Now, is this the first time this isn't the first time these tax credit programs have been countervailed, is it?
It's the first, the SBA review was the first time that the logging tax credit came up. It was not in the underlying investigation. But it was in this executive review and will appear, does appear in subsequent administrative reviews.
Okay, but not in lumbers 1, 2, 3, however many we have before.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Nancy Noonan from Aaron Fox on behalf of the Government of Quebec. I just wanted to point to some specific parts of the record to sort of pull it all together. First, and then just to level set, the provinces own the forest. They are in charge of maintaining the health and sustainability of the forest. So the logging tax credit, the logging tax in and of itself, and the tax credits is part of how the government has the money to take care of the forest. So getting to the record in terms of the timing of the sequence.
Does that mean that the logging tax doesn't apply in situations where there's private forest land being logged?
I think it does apply to private forest land, Your Honor. Yes, I see your point. So. But there are sustainability provisions that also go to the private forest in terms of what has to be reported to the government and insects and fires and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so I wanted to point to Exhibit 17A of the Joint Appendix. This is the federal government's legislative history relating to the logging tax credit. And on page 2709, which is page 76 of the appendix. The quote is, during the period covered by the current agreements, companies engaged in the forest industries in British Columbia and Ontario have borne a considerably higher burden of tax rates than other industries. This is because of the combined effect of the federal income taxes and provincial logging taxes. So that gets to our point that Quebec did not have a logging tax in effect at that time when the federal program went into effect. We have an excerpt on the record of the Quebec logging tax and logging tax credit, which has the year 1972 associated with it. But in getting the court's questions and working with the client, I did learn that actually the logging tax was in effect a bit earlier, but we do not have that information on the record. If you would like that earlier provision on the record, please just let me know. I also want to point out that the logging tax return on the record in Exhibit 18F, Note 12 has the language notifying the logging tax filer that they can be taking these other deductions on their federal tax return and their Quebec tax return. So to us, that's part and parcel of, at least for the Quebec program, how this was all put together at the same time, but so that the actual company would never be paying more tax than other corporations in Quebec, because that would be double taxation on, at least on that portion of their logging income. But it was notifying them that they would be paying nothing, really, though Quebec does indeed get a benefit because Quebec is getting the extra money. But Quebec is not foregoing any revenue because they are continuing to get that full 11% that Mr. Magnus referred to of the corporate tax.
Just as a side question, probably not necessarily relevant to the legal issues here, why go through all the convoluted, for the provincial part, is this the, maintain the full employment for Quebec or Quebecois tax accountants, or why?
Well, Your Honor, there is some legislative history. Unfortunately, it is not on the record. It is something that I learned in preparing your responses. If you would like it on the record, I would be more than happy to find a way to get it in there. But I think what we do know is at the time Quebec instituted their logging tax, which was simultaneous with their tax credit, they knew that they were going to be getting, they were going to have two-thirds of that income through the federal government's process. Like at the end of the day, that was the reality. So on your question about, you know, whether this was the purpose of it was to give Quebec or the other provinces the income, I mean, I think from the federal perspective, we do have on the record that no, it was all about we can't have double taxation. From the Quebec perspective, what we do know is at the time they actually enacted it, they knew they were going to get this two-thirds, and the company, again, is not paying it because they're being made whole.
Is it set up so that the federal tax credit can only ever be two-thirds, and so therefore the province has to impose a three-thirds tax self-credit?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right. And again,
to be able to get the two-thirds from the federal.
That's exactly right. And if you look at, you know, again, Exhibit 18F, which is an example of the logging tax return, Note 12, you'll see where that's all laid out there. Let's see. We talked about, and then Quebec also has a provision against double taxation. You can see in the Joint Appendix 18E, there is a Revenue Quebec. It's considered a confidential letter because Revenue Quebec takes their confidentiality very, very seriously, but you can see language in there that that you're not allowed to double tax. We also, like Mr. Cashin said, it turns out in looking into this and preparing for these questions, there are tax provisions that are more specific to it and say that, but they are not on the record. Happy to provide them if that would be useful to the court. Let's see. I guess the only other thing about this, the combined effects of the provincial and federal, mm-hmm. you know, there have been other lumber cases also tax programs, so they don't have that at the same time, an extra tax being put into place and then the credit. But we have seen Commerce combine federal and provincial tax credits for Quebec and the federal government. That would be the CCA for Class 1 assets. That would be in the lumber, for example, wait, where's my site? Sorry. Okay, that would be the decision memo for the final results of the administrative review for 2021. That's 88-ITA-DOC-50103 from August 1, 2023. Just as an example of the time that Commerce has combined the federal and the provincial into one lump sum. And if nothing else, I will sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Beck.
We don't have too much to add, Your Honor. With respect to question one, we think that nothing, regardless of the order of the logging tax, whether it predates the tax credit, we don't think that anything supports the Canadian plaintiffs' claim that the federal logging tax credit, the PLTC, and the Quebec logging tax were enacted to serve as a single action. As we argued in our brief and is supported by the record evidence, the FLTC, the PLTC, and the Quebec logging tax are distinct actions enacted at different times. With respect to number two, we're not aware of any record evidence that supports the fact that the FLTC or PLTC stand or fall together within Canada. We think the record supports only that the FLTC and PLTC were enacted to provide a tax credit to taxes that were otherwise due, and Commerce does not consider the financial arrangement, the alleged transfer of wealth from the Government of Canada to the Government of Quebec as a factor in its benefit analysis. We're also not aware of record evidence demonstrating the norm is based on a legal requirement instead of a policy preference.
The basic point on these, though, is that, I mean, the agency looked at them all distinctly
And which, I mean, it's an issue that's arisen in a number of cases that I've had lately where, I mean, the real question and the thing that we've, that would help in terms of providing clarity for the agency determination and for court review is for the agency to be more clear as to what is the program specifically that it's looking at and why are the parameters of that program what the agency says are the parameters, so that things that the agency says are distinct and should be looked at distinctly, in fact, are such, and we can review that in a more clear fashion. But
we think this. For the third question, we don't think that there is record evidence supporting that a transfer of wealth between the Canadian government and the Quebecois government was the purpose of the tax credit. We think that the record evidence supports that the policy rationale for enacting the FLTC and PLTC is to provide a credit on logging taxes. And we note, as Commerce discussed in the IDM, the fact that Government of Canada tax credits are applied against each individual company's tax returns as opposed to refunding to the Quebecois government.
What do you say in response to Mr. Cashin's argument, and you know, I think supported by his colleagues, that this is like the Sri Lanka case. I mean, it is money that is simply being washed through the tax credit recipient. They're not actually getting any of this money. It's just a mechanism for moving money from one hand to a third hand, and it just happens to have to go through this second hand. So they're not, just like in Sri Lanka, that second hand is not actually reaping any benefit from having cash pass through their hands.
And I think here we think the record doesn't contain evidence to support that it's just a transfer of funds. I mean, looking at the supplemental questionnaire response, that it says that the purpose of the measure, together with parallel credits provided by provinces that impose logging taxes, is intended to offset provincial logging taxes imposed on taxpayers engaged in logging activities, which results of logging taxes would bear a higher burden of the tax rates. Looking at the FLTC-1 exhibit, the legislative history that we've talked about.
How does that respond to the question? Help me understand that.
We just simply don't think that the records has the court's outlined that it's a transfer or a washing of hands. We just don't think that the record supports that here, that it shows that there's the one-third credit and the two-third credit, and it doesn't support that these are just simply the transfer that the Canadian parties have been describing in their questionnaire responses.
But, I mean, that's kind of a conclusion without a rationale. Other than stating that the absence of something else. But, I mean, I think here, I mean, when we're talking about, you know, when you look at the existence of the three, I want to call them programs, the three legal provisions, let's call them, together, that, you know, they end up adding up in the pocket, with regard to the pocket of a logging company, amounts to zero.
Commerce, I don't think, found that from the record in this case, and doesn't think that the record, provided that kind of evidence.
Where do they explain why that's not the case? I mean, they can state contrary conclusions all the time. I mean, the arguments were made. Where is the explanation?
Certainly, Your Honor, I'm happy to go back to the issues and decision memorandum. I think Commerce explained why it thought they were separate benefits and why there was a revenue foregone by the government. In terms of turning to I don't have a further question at this time. We'd be happy to provide something else if the court would like that. In terms of the last question, we were unaware of a Commerce determination, or we didn't find one, where Commerce combined effects of taxes and credits involving more than one governmental entity. Commerce has previously combined programs in the past, and we submit that Commerce has the discretion to determine whether a program under review should be treated as a single program or several programs,
because it is possible that governments are increasingly sophisticated in countervailing duty law and may choose to obscure their actions by pursuing complex multi-stage subsidy programs. Although it wasn't cited in our brief, in Hynix Semiconductor, which is 391 Fed Sup 2D, at 1337, Court of International Trade 2005, the question before the court was whether Commerce was permitted to frame each transaction made by different financial institutions at issue as a single government-directed program of financial contributions, and the court there determined that Commerce had the discretion to determine whether a program should be treated as a single program or separate programs.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jessica Link on behalf of the Coalition. I won't go through all the points that my colleague from the Department of Justice just went through, but I'll just hit a few quick points. Just taking a step back, I think, the arguments of the Canadian parties, I think they're trying to overly complicate what is otherwise a very straightforward issue under both the statute and the regulation. Just under the statute, the question is the government foregoing or not collecting revenue that it otherwise would be owed or that the company would otherwise have to pay? Yes, that's very clear here. But for the tax credits, the lumber producers would have to pay this tax. I mean, that's very clear from the record.
I think that your argument is easier to make. I suspect you'll agree, with regard to the federal tax credit. It's a little more of a challenge with regard to the provincial one, isn't it?
I guess if you're speaking about, this temporal aspect of what came first, I think...
Even within any given, presumably, you tell me if I'm misunderstanding, but presumably within any provincial tax return, there's going to be some line someplace buried in the whole thing that, represents that logging tax, the extra 10%, and then probably 12 pages later and after some complicated formulas, there's going to be some negative adjustment for one-third of what appeared on the previous line with regard to the logging tax.
Right, yes.
So there, the fact that it's a couple of pages later that it appears on two separate lines of the same tax return makes it completely distinct, and we have to turn a blind eye to that fact?
But it's a financial contribution, right? The whole question is, but for those tax credits, which the government doesn't have to provide, but for those, that they wouldn't be getting that money back or that money would be owed. So, and I think,
But if you look at it I take your point about overly complicating, but in the, you could also make the argument that you're overly simplifying and sort of, zooming in on just one issue at, one tree, forgive the analogy, one tree and ignoring the forest.
I think where it gets simple is just the plain language of the statute. Tax credits are specifically identified there. There's no requirement for how these taxes are structured. Commerce has the discretion under the statute to look at a program such as this, see, are the facts aligning? Is the government, has it set up this program to forego or not?
That question,
collect
what
it?
Is the program?
As Commerce had laid it out, it looks at two separate, looks at it separately.
I think Ms. Noonan would say, hey, look, the only reason that 10% tax exists with the one-third credit is because we have to go through those steps in order to get to the two-thirds.
As you were pointing to, what's on the record most clearly is, the evidence from the federal government and that legislative history. We just don't have the benefit of what the Quebec lawmakers, what...
If we did?
What they were in mind. I'd say that
is
the statute... No, I think the statute still holds. That, is the government, they've set this up, that they are going to forego or not collect revenue that they otherwise would have access to. And they haven't done that. So
So that's why I keep saying that it's very straightforward. It's also straightforward when you look at the plain language of the regulation. What would the producers have to pay, you know, except for these tax credits? And that record is very clear what they would have to pay in the absence of the tax credits. Just to sort of tie up some final points, you know, this discussion about, you know, the double taxation, is this a norm or legal preference? You know, is it a legal requirement or just a policy preference? Again, we'd say the record doesn't support that there is, you know, some firm requirement that this has to happen. The record reflects that this is a policy preference, easing the tax burden on the logging producers. That is what the overwhelming evidence shows. There's, you know, again, the record is also devoid of evidence that the intent behind all this or the policy purpose was to transfer the wealth from the federal to the provincial governments. The record's just not there to support those arguments. So unless the court has anything else, I think those are all the points I need to make. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. John Magnus from Obelia Aristique. I'll be very brief. The court asked a couple of questions that sounded like they were policy questions that we'd like an opportunity to answer as well, if we may.
Sure.
One was under the legal theory that we're advancing, would it become impossible to ever countervail a tax credit?
Mm-hmm.
Because a tax credit sometimes is made available in response to a taxpayer taking on some kind of an obligation. We don't think that concern exists. I mean, tax credits sometimes are provided in circumstances where a taxpayer engages in some kind of an activity. We've just enacted quite a few of them in the United States. There's a tax credit for, you know, engaging in certain kinds of renewable energy manufacturing in the United States. And there's nothing nothing in our theory here that would prevent tax credits as a category from ever being countervailed. What's complicated here is that if the type of financial contribution you're looking at is revenue foregone, then there essentially is no benefit analysis. It's like a grant, right? It's treated as conferring a benefit automatically, right? And here, in respect of what the federal government has done, even if you think it's a financial contribution, you still have to ask, well, benefit to whom? It's beneficial to somebody, but it isn't beneficial to anybody manufacturing lumber.
Why not? Because for that, the benefit is it's relieving you of the two-thirds obligation in terms of your, you know, that's otherwise due to the provincial government.
So this gets back to the court's question about the timing. When the FLTC was put in place, it did not, in fact, relieve anybody in Quebec from an existing obligation. There was no such obligation. The obligation came along later and was put in place under circumstances where the government of Quebec knew that no company would bear surtaxation on any portion of its income.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not like the situation where a government simultaneously puts in place an obligation and then maybe on a selective basis, excuse me.
Back to the analogy that you were providing in terms of, you know, presumably talking about, you know, tax credits for, you know, renewable energy and things like that. I mean, clear language in the preamble that talks about, well, you know, you get a tax credit for that. It doesn't matter if there is some, you know, any financial contribution that a firm gets to help it accomplish good climate goals, for example, you don't look at what's the overall climate policy and the overall imposition of a, you know, whether it's a carbon tax or whether it is a, you know, a cap and trade type system or, you know, any kind of other
mm-hmm.
Obligation with regard to recognizing costs to the environment. You don't offset those two. They are looked at distinctly. Why is this any different?
This is different because
of who benefits. The beneficiary of a tax credit for renewable manufacturing is the renewable manufacturer. The beneficiary of this scheme, unless you put blinkers on and zero in on one piece of it, the beneficiary of this scheme is the provincial government. And the only way you can conclude otherwise is to take a blinkered approach.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, everybody benefits on, you make the argument, everybody benefits on the environmental policy.
I guess what I mean is the financial beneficiary mm-hmm. of this scheme. Who's better off in the sense?
Well, doesn't your point have to be that it's not the recipient of the credit that benefits? And arguably that's the same in both scenarios.
I'm not sure I followed the question. Maybe this is the question. Can a financial contribution to Party A meet the benefit test if it confers a benefit on Party B? And, you know, here what you have is, in respect of the federal, the provincial one isn't even a financial contribution. There's just no imaginable way to look at these facts and see that the provincial government is forgoing any revenue. And so in the absence of some other kind of financial contribution, you could call it, no reason to even look at benefit. We acknowledge that for the federal credit, that the federal government...
But is it any different than, I mean, the provincial, let's say the provincial government enacts a carbon tax and says, okay, but yeah, we recognize certain carbon-intensive industries are going to be hurt by this, and so we're going to give, you know, and obviously you get your specificity and such there, but we're going to give all the steel mills credit for 2/3 of the carbon tax. It's the exact same scenario. I mean, it's still the same pocket that all the money ends up in.
This is the scenario that was addressed in the preamble, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. If a government puts an environmental rule in place and then exempts a favored enterprise from the compliance costs, then that's absolutely a benefit. That's not what happened here. Here, the provincial measure was put in place under circumstances where it was perfectly clear that no taxpayer would ever bear one single penny of actual surtaxation liability. This isn't about singling out one regulated party and saying, yeah, we're going to give you a break because we don't want the full weight of this to land on you. Right? This is about putting in place and simultaneously for everybody canceling a surtax. That's why in our brief we call it a phantom surtax. It isn't the scenario addressed in the preamble. It's a measure which, unless you look at only one piece of it, it negates itself. They impose and simultaneously for everybody unimpose this surtax on a portion of income.
Okay.
And that's why we think it's distinct. And just to wrap up, the Hynek's case in no way said that commerce was permitted to countervail in the absence of a financial contribution, which is what you have here with respect to the provincial measure, or in the absence of a benefit to the company being examined, which is what you have here in respect of the FLTC. Thank you.
Nancy Noonan from the Governor of Quebec. Just a couple of very quick points. Very important distinction to this regime is that this relates to income. So there already is an income tax rate that applies to all corporations in Quebec. Then from that same income, but the portion of it that's associated with the logging income, they have to file this separate 6-page return indicating what their logging income is. So I think it is a big difference between some other type, even the carbon tax program, because that's not going to be an income program. So this is logging tax income. Actually, that's really all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Why does that matter?
It matters because it gets to that whole you can't double tax the same income. That's we have language on the record about that. So the federal tax in and of itself, the FLTC, was about correcting that double taxation. So again, we believe the record.
Finally, just internalizing what's otherwise a. Okay.
So our perspective is the timing is important. It does show and support the record that this logging tax would not exist but for the fact that there was the federal logging tax credit and the provincial tax credit so that
our Quebec corporations would all still be taxed at the same rate overall. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Anything further? All right. Fontaine, Mr. Leonard.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mark Leonard, Law Office of David L. Simon, on behalf of Fontaine. In the questions that the court posed to the parties regarding the tax year.
Let me take a different approach to it for a second. I mean, I think I understand your point, that your argument is that under the provincial system, governmental system, you're obligated, your client's obligated to pay the tax money that's going to be due must be in the hands of the government by the end of the end of the calendar year.
Yeah, at the end of the 2 months following the fiscal year, which is the end of the calendar
year. End of the calendar year, okay. So the money has to be in the government's hands by then.
Yes.
All right. It's also true, to the extent that I could figure out from the tax returns that we saw, that both with respect to 2014 and with respect to 2015, there is a difference between the amount that was paid to the government by the end of the calendar year and the amount of the final amount of tax liability for Fontaine.
That is correct. In 2014, there was an underpayment that had to be made up in December of 2014. But for all the other taxes, the logging tax had to be paid, but for the federal and the Quebec taxes, generally they overpaid and we're going to get a reimbursement.
Right. In other words, the final amount of liability was not set until the tax returns were filed.
No, that's incorrect. The final tax...
They were getting a refund, right?
Yes.
Okay, which you just said. So, right, which is based on the tax return, isn't it?
It's based on the payments that are made by the payment due date.
Right.
And
but the amount of refund is not set somewhere until they actually file the return, right?
No, that's incorrect, because the reason is the payment is due on the payment due date. And at that point, there is a calculation that the accountants do, and they know how much the refund's going to be, and they know how much any underpayment is that has to be paid by December 31st. In terms of identifying for purposes of government information how much the refund is, or that there is no refund because everything was paid, or in a case not present with Fontaine, some underpayment that wasn't made, but that information goes to the government when the tax is filed. It's like in the U.S., April 15th is tax day,
mm-hmm.
but you can get an extension until October 15th. But if you get the extension until October 15th, you still have to pay on April 15th. And if you don't, penalties and interest.
Right.
Same thing under Canadian tax law.
But if you're getting a refund, that amount, you can wait, you end up waiting until your extension date to determine that. So to the extent that the critical issue for purposes of the subsidy calculation is what is the final tax liability? I mean, I think that's, at the end of the day, isn't that the question?
Well, I think it's maybe split. You're talking about the amount of the benefit as opposed to the date of receipt of the benefit. The amount of the benefit, let's say, actually doesn't become final until, you have the date that the tax has to be paid, the date the taxes, the return has to be filed. There may be a date of a formal assessment by the government. There may be a date of government audit. There might be a date of, final appeal by the taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
So when, determining what the benefit is, we'd have to wait until the appeal period runs. But in terms of when...
isn't your argument supporting the... Don't those facts support what Commerce did here then?
No.
Well, because we don't know, because the number's not really the number, because, notwithstanding the fact that they were supposed to have it all done, nobody ever knows what the final number is, and so we're going to take all the information that we have with regard to the period of review and make our best calculations.
Well, Commerce had this debate in the preamble.
Right.
Beginning in 1989, 97 with the draft preamble and the 98 preamble. And in those, in that discussion, Commerce identified three different dates, or four, I guess, technically. One is the date that the party knew its tax liability, the date that the party calculated its tax liability, the date that the party otherwise had to pay the taxes, and the date that it files its tax return. And of those dates, Commerce selected the date that the recipient firm otherwise would have had to pay the taxes. So Commerce had this debate when it promulgated the regulations, and straying from that is impermissible under Glycine and Moore and Thomas Jefferson. Commerce cannot stray from the intent at the time of the regulations, and looking at the regulation itself. It's clear that unlike Commerce and the petitioners have claimed that the regulation sets the date as the date of filing, it actually sets the date as the date that the recipient firm otherwise would have had to pay the taxes. It observes in the second sentence that normally that date is the same as the date the tax is filed, but even in the U.S., that doesn't happen all the time for anyone who gets an extension. And in Canada, it never happens. Well, that is to say, under the law, it doesn't happen because the law separates those two dates. It would be as if in the U.S. you had to pay your taxes by February 15th, but then file your return by April 15th. It's the same separation under the tax law in Canada. Payment 2 months after the end of the fiscal year and filing the tax return within 6 months after the end of the fiscal year. There is, at the beginning of the first sentence...
What you're arguing for?
We're arguing that in the regulation, Commerce set the date as the timing of the receipt of the benefit as the date that the recipient firm otherwise would have had to pay the taxes. For Fontaine, that means the 2014 taxes were paid or had to be paid in 2014, and the date of receipt of the benefit is 2014. Here, the POR of the expedited review is 2015.
Right.
So 2014 taxes and any benefit under 2014 taxes are irrelevant and actually contrary to Commerce's regulations and the law governing what can be countervailed. What's relevant is the 2015 taxes, which had to be paid and were paid in 2015.
And to the extent that, as you've acknowledged, there was a refund provided in 2016 after the returns were filed, where do those get addressed? Or are you...
Those are largely irrelevant. What we're looking at in the 2015 tax return is what benefits they received under various programs, what the calculation of the subsidy is for those benefits. So that they received a refund just means that they overpaid their taxes. It doesn't, it's not necessarily relevant to whether there were countervailable subsidies or what those subsidies were.
The amount.
The amount of the subsidies, right. It's just a general refund.
And then, let me just ask, as I'm recalling, and it may be that it's an issue in terms of how we, what we were looking at. It appeared to me, and I think I can ask this question sufficiently generally without giving any BPI, in looking at the 2015 return. One of the issues here is the government says, hey, look, when we look at their returns, they've got all these installment payments,
mm-hmm.
and the installment payments are all identical, which they are basically. One would expect under your telling of the facts that, at a minimum, even if they're all basically the same, that the December number might be fairly distinct because that's when the accountant has told the company, okay, here's what you got to do, that the December number would represent that reconciliation number, which is not necessarily the case. But in particular, and this is where the real gist of my question, but you can address that first part as well. It looked like for the 2015 return, and maybe I'm looking at the wrong chart or something, that the dates of all those installment payments are for the following fiscal year, because they run from 2015 through into 2016.
Yeah. For the first part, you're right, and the information does reflect a different payment in December. And let me explain. This also answers your second question. The installment payment, and we see in the record, there is a document dated January 2014, which is for the 2014 tax year, and January 2015 for the 2015 tax year. And that's the schedule of estimated installment payments, and there are 12 of them.
Mm-hmm.
The first payment, however, is the first month of the fiscal year, which is for 2014, it's November 2013. And the second payment is December 2013. And then the next 10 are through October 2014. And if you look at, the estimated schedule for 2014, I believe, you'll see that the first two payments are different from the remaining 10. That's on an estimated basis. And the reason is because the January 2014 schedule that was submitted after the November and December payments. The November payment, the estimated payments are generally based on the prior year's tax liability. In November of 2013, they did not know what the 2013 tax liability was yet. In December of 2013, they had calculated it because they needed to know by December 31. And what you see is the December payment is higher than the November payment. So the November payment it's just using round numbers that are not BPI. Say it's a $10,000 payment in November and then a $32,428 payment in December. When you average those two, you get the number that is the remaining 10 payments through October of the end of the fiscal year. So number one, these are estimated payments. And when you look at the accounting records, and I'm going to point to a couple of pages on the in the joint appendix. It's tab 13A, mm-hmm. I believe, and it's ECF 149-3. And I'm going to use the page number at the top of the page where it has the ECF and the PDF page out of the total number. On ECF 149-3, PDF page 37 and 126. 37 is the French version, 126 is the translated version. You see the payments from the accounting records. And on the left side, you see 01, 02, 03, 04, all the way to 12, and that shows the payments. And if you compare those with the installment payment estimates, and this is on page 50 of ECF 149-3, they don't match up. And they generally don't match up because of the adjustment that's made, and also because during the year they may make some other adjustments. For 2014, they saw that they were going to be significantly light on their tax payments for what they expected the liability to be for 2014. And so you see, I believe it's in November of 2014, you see a significantly larger payment that was added in. And then for 2014 in December, they also had to add in the last payment, which was a few thousand dollars, to make up the difference in the underpayment that they calculated. But those two, although on the tax return, it's the sum of installments, those two were not estimated payments that were estimated at the beginning of the year. They were payments that Fontaine saw, or its accountant saw, Fontaine needed to catch up, number one, and then two, to close the final gap before the end of the tax year when the payment was due. 2014 is interesting because it's the only year where there was an underpayment. Generally, Fontaine overpays and gets a refund. It's just a matter of the company policy. But you do see in 2014 the fact that although there are installment payments, there's still an effect of, you know, the final calculation by the accountants in December to make sure that Fontaine has paid the taxes by the end of the 2-month period. And you see also in the email from the accountants, this is PDF page 51 and the translation on 128 of ECF 149.3, the accountants say, make sure you've paid this by December 31st, because that is the date that the taxes otherwise had to be paid. So in terms of installments, although...
Let me ask you this. Let me just step back from it all. I mean, to focus on sort of where we are with the issue is that we're trying to figure out here. I mean, what is the relevance of the tax, and this maybe goes back to part of what you were saying earlier, what's the relevance of the tax return then? I mean, because I think you're saying, look, if everything has to be paid and the tax return, yeah, maybe it, whether it shows a refund or not, it doesn't establish the amount of the benefit that's otherwise established.
Right.
So is the refund simply a triggering date? And, I mean, if that's the case, I mean, whether they used 2014 or 2015, what are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, in terms of the refund, I think that's a red herring, right? I mean, because it's not related to any program or the calculation of...
But what is the relevance of the fact that they said, okay, you're using the 2014 return?
I mean, in terms of big picture, what happens to Fontaine?
No, specifically in terms of this case.
Yeah, well, according to our calculations, if it's a 2014 tax return, then Fontaine's above de minimis, and if it's the 2015, it's below de minimis.
But what are they pulling? What is it that they're pulling from the tax return as opposed to pulling from the payments that were made in 2015? What are they pulling from the 2014 tax return filed in 2015 versus pulling from the payments made in 2015 that's relevant to this?
Well, there are two things. Number one is, if you look in the 1989 regulations, Commerce says that it's trying to equate the date of receipt with a cash flow effect, right? And that cash flow effect is when the company makes its payment, right? In terms of wanting a firm date that won't change, right, because the date of the filing of the tax return could change. It actually could be a point of gaming the system, right,
What I'm asking you here is, I mean, explain to me the practical effect within this case of the argument that you're making. What is the mistake, what's the impact of the alleged mistake that Commerce made?
Then Commerce uses Commerce is looking for to calculate the benefit received by Fontaine during the period of review.
Mm-hmm.
So the mistake is that because the time of receipt or the timing of the receipt of the benefit is when the company otherwise had to pay its taxes, then the 2014 tax return, which had to be paid in 2014, is before the POR and not relevant to any POR discussion of benefits received and calculation of the duties.
But you told me earlier that the return is also not relevant to the determination of the amount of the benefit.
No, it's not. I mean, the refund isn't relevant. I mean, because the refund isn't attached to any particular program. It's just overall payments and liabilities, right? But the return itself has the information in terms of the Government of Canada, you know, it'd be like here, if you pay taxes but you don't give a refund or don't declare what it is, then the government doesn't know whether you overpaid or underpaid. Right? Mm-hmm. It's information for the for the government in terms of auditing. But for commerce, that's where they see the reporting of benefits received during the POR. And in terms of tax programs under the regulation, the benefits received that are deemed as received during the POR are the ones that are where the taxes had to otherwise be paid during the POR. And in Fontaine's case, that's the 2015 tax return. I'd note that in Section 509B1, there are two, the word normally is used twice.
Mm-hmm.
In the first sentence, the normally is provides the sort of the rule of when the timing of the benefit is. That is, normally when the recipient firm otherwise would have had to pay the taxes. The second sentence, the normally is, observing when Commerce expects that to be, which is normally when it files the taxes, although the second normally establishes that Commerce expected that there would be times or cases where the file date would not be the date of for the receipt of benefit, just normally. The first normally, however, if you go back to the 1989 regulations, it explains why there would be why it expected there would be times when the date that the firm otherwise had to pay its taxes or whatever the date is wouldn't occur. And that is, it explained that Commerce intended to include an exception where application of the general rule would enable certain countervailable subsidies to go unremedied. Typically, these situations involve big ticket items, the production and delivery of which may extend over several years, CEG, offshore platform jackets, and piles from Korea. So the first normally is if the application of the general rule would allow some subsidies to go unremedied. In this case, application of the general rule allows a remedy for the benefits received in 2015. So there is no reason for Commerce to stray from the first sentence setting the date or the timing of the receipt of the benefits. And the second sentence does not require Commerce to do one thing or another, just observes that normally the date of filing or the date payment is required normally coincides with the filing.
Okay. Is there anything, I don't want to prolong this much longer, but I do understand your points, and I think where I'm having trouble is reconciling the points that you're making with the practical aspects of the agency having to calculate the subsidy rate. And so, I think what you're saying is, you've got an argument that says, well, look, the timing, when they have to pay, they've got to pay throughout the year. I get that. But what I believe you've also said is the actual statement of for the individual programs, for example, the amount of the benefit is stated in the tax return. The refund, whether it's a refund or not, that's a separate matter. I get it. But the identification of those amounts mm-hmm. happens in the tax return.
Yes.
Okay. So if that's the case, why is it unreasonable for Commerce to interpret the had to pay as the, particularly given the fact that there can be adjustments in terms of the amount that's paid based on whatever the final number is in the tax return, for them to interpret the had to pay as being the date that the return's filed?
It's unreasonable because it's contrary to the plain language of the regulation and to the intent of the regulation at the time it was promulgated. The regulation says the date, the timing of receipt is when the company had to pay the taxes. And you see this in Oman, was it Nails from Oman, which is cited in all the briefs, but in that case, the Omani company was entitled to an exemption of taxes, and it didn't file its tax return. And then it realized that it actually had to apply for it by a certain date to receive the exemption. So it didn't get the exemption, and after the POI, paid the taxes. Commerce used the date that the taxes had to be paid and the fact that the company didn't qualify for the exemption to find that it didn't receive that benefit. Even though the tax return identifying that exemption or paying the taxes that it could have been exempted from was filed later, Commerce looked at the date. And the reason, I think it makes perfect sense.
I mean, isn't that consistent with how where we are here? That it's the end of the day until all the paperwork's done.
No, I think
the number's not final.
I think it's consistent with the plain language of the regulation. It makes sense because Commerce is looking for a date that they can point to every year. It won't change, so you can't game the system and get an extension on your taxes, and then you don't have a tax return filed for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a date that will happen every year and is applicable to every country.
Why they use 2014? Because it was during the POR.
No. They used 2014 because it was filed during the POR. But when you use the date that the taxes had to be paid, that date doesn't change. Like in the U.S., you have to pay on April 15th. You can file it 2 or 3 years later, but it has to be paid on April 15th. In Canada, it has to be paid 2 months after the end of the POR.
I understand your argument.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Ms. Speck?
Your Honor, I don't have too much more to say on this.
If the 2015 tax filing was on the record, and, accepting the legal point that Mr. Leonard made, that, under Canadian law, the taxes have to be paid by the end of the calendar year. I mean, I understand, there's the practical aspect of not knowing, different countries have different systems and time frames for when you file a return, but here it was sufficiently soon after the end of the calendar year that it was available and provided and on the record. I mean, why didn't the agency just use the FY 2015 tax return?
As Commerce explained, it didn't conclude that the amount due was definitively known until the return was filed, and looking at the documents that we've seen so far, they talked about estimated payments, and the court's already talked about this, and here Commerce concluded that it's an estimate until the return is actually filed, and that's why it used the return that it did. The liability.
Well, I mean, the problem is, what is the 2014? The 2014 return speaks to what the benefits received in 2014, not 2015, which is the period of review.
Right, but that was when it was filed. I mean, I guess the Commerce concluded that when Fontaine paid its taxes in 2014, the changes to its liability could have changed until it filed the taxes. Commerce simply adhered to its standard practice because the tax liability was not finalized until it filed the returns, which occurred in 2015.
Okay. Does the agency accept that there can be a difference between the date that there's the obligation to have paid the tax and the date of the tax return?
Certainly the agency has acknowledged, which went to the court's question, the first question here is that they're...
Where did they grapple with the arguments that were made by the respondent as to the fact that this was a case in which there was a recognizable distinction between, a cognizable distinction between those two?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, certainly they went through pages 94 and 95 of the IDM. They certainly went through cases where the cases that Fontaine had cited where Commerce departed from its standard practice and explained why those didn't apply in these circumstances. It explained that it identified the language in the CBD preamble, and it says it equates the timing of the benefit with the timing of the date. It went through the fact that the final full paragraph on page 94 goes through the fact that why Commerce concluded that it didn't know the full extent of its tax liability until it filed the return. It cited the installments made, and that the record cited the annual installments plan, and that all of that indicated that Fontaine did not have definitive knowledge. Commerce discussed in our brief at pages 44 and 45 and also again in these pages of the IDM, Commerce discussed other circumstances where it had departed from the practice And it had concluded, it talked about cuts to length plates in Korea and other cases where there were circumstances that provided a basis for departing from Commerce's standard practice, and it explained why it didn't find those to be here. And that's all I have. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
So again, Your Honor, Jessica Link on behalf of the Coalition. I'll just make one quick point, and I'll return there. Just to Your Honor's first question, about this timing of, if they had the 2015 tax returns on the record, why not use those? I believe, under the regulation, Commerce was looking at the 2014 tax returns filed during the POR, which was 2015, mm-hmm. for assessing that is when the benefit was established. That was when
the benefit received during calendar year 20 or fiscal year 2014.
Right. Right, but again, it's the date on which the firm knows definitively the amount of its tax liability during the POR, that was when those tax returns were filed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but the 2015 returns were also available.
That is true, they were there. But looking at when the tax return was filed was during this POR, the 2015 POR, and that's what Commerce ultimately went with. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mark Lennon on behalf of Fontaine, just a couple quick points. One is that the requirements of Canadian tax law are not disputed by any party in terms of when the payment was due and when the return is filed. Two, Commerce and petitioners talk about when the taxes are definitively known. That is not in the tax, in the regulation at all. And if definitively known were actually what Commerce were seeking after, we'd have to wait until any appeal period for the taxpayer ran. Because until that appeal period runs, nobody can say definitively what exactly the tax is. Regarding installments, in terms of knowledge, payment, none of those really matter because the regulation points to a legal point in time, which is when the taxes had to be paid. But in terms of installments, the government argued that it's just an estimate until Fontaine filed. But when you look at the 2014 taxes, the amount that Fontaine paid, the sum of the amount of the November 2013 through October 2014 installments, and I think that's sort of a misleading term because it's applied to everything, but and in addition the couple thousand dollars extra in December, on December 23rd, 2014, those sum precisely to the liability reported in the tax return. So it was definitive in terms of...
But they ended up receiving a refund.
Not for the 2014 federal taxes. So 2014 federal taxes, they paid exactly what they declared in their tax return was their liability. There was no refund. There's a refund 2014 provincial tax for Quebec. And in 2015, there was a federal and Quebec tax refund. But in 2014, there was no federal refund and no federal underpayment as of December 31st. And the government also argued that the amount could have changed, but our argument, of course, is that it doesn't matter because the payment due date was December 31st. And penalties and interest run from that date. And finally, Commerce acknowledged that the regulation does admit the possibility of different pay and file dates. That aspect of the regulation necessarily implies two things. Number one, that Commerce contemplated that the dates would be different, or could be different, rather. And number two, that it would be a material aspect, meaning that the payment would be in 1 year and the return filed in a separate year. Because if it was just a difference of dates and not a difference of years, it would be immaterial for the purposes of calculating countervailing subsidies. If the court has no further questions, Fontaine argues that the plain language of the regulation admits only one result, and that is that the 2014 tax return cannot be used, and Commerce must use the 2015 tax return to calculate benefits. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We've exhausted the questions. The question is whether we've exhausted the answers thereof, or, I mean, if anyone, as I said at the beginning, I mean, if there are any issues, points that any of you all wanted to raise at the end of this process, I would give you that opportunity. And I will say, I'm looking to see if there's a sense that anybody wants to make any further arguments and whether we need to take a break before we begin that process or not. Ms. Lynn?
We would like to briefly present on our count two, if that's possible.
Okay. How briefly do you want to be?
Well, I have two paragraphs prepared, so depending on your question.
Is there a sense, and I will also ask that to the backs of the heads that I'm looking at here, because I know most of you have taken, many of you have taken your own personal breaks. As necessary. Do we need to take a short break, or we're good to go? All right. Let's keep it going. All right. Go ahead, Ms. Lynn.
So thank you for the opportunity to present that issue. So count two is about whether Commerce violated its own regulation by excluding the de minimis companies as if they were never part of the order. The regulation says at K3, well, now it's L3-2 says...
I mean, at the time it was K3.
K3-2, yes. K3-2 says the results of the CVDXR review will not be the basis for assessment of...
Well, why don't we just jump to the relevant question
there,
because you seem to ignore, I mean, how...
No, I know, yes.
The court, like the agency, has to read the regulations in their entirety, to read them as a whole.
Okay. Sure.
And I can't read three without reading four.
Yes, so
and
we
four
acknowledge
says if you're
three.
De minimis, you get excluded. So how do I read three to do what you want it to do and also read four to exclude those parties?
Okay, so we have an explanation for that. So we know that two says you cannot use it for the assessment of duty. Three says
three at the time. Okay.
Commerce may exclude the de minimis companies from the order.
Uh-huh.
But I think there's still a question of whether that means that you exclude the companies going forward after the final results are issued, or going from the very beginning as if they were never part of the order. In an admin review, if a company gets de minimis, they don't just get excluded from the order. It doesn't mean that they are excluded from the very beginning. It means that they are excluded for that period, and their cash deposit rate is zero for that period of time. So, Commerce
excluded. I mean, are you saying in an administrative review when they get a de minimis that they're excluded?
No, they're still in the order.
Yeah. And there's no reference to the terminology of exclusion never applies. It's just that they're assessed without regard to countervailing duty rates.
Right. So here it says they can be excluded from the order, but I think there's still a question of whether that means after the final results of the CVDXR reviews are issued or before from the very beginning, as if they were never part of the order. And the CVDXR review companies have been paying cash deposits from when the prelim of the investigation was issued to when the final results of the CVDXR review were issued. So they were like about a little bit more than 2 years' time. So if the regulation were to be read consistent with all the provisions are consistent with one another, then if Commerce were to exclude them from the very beginning, that means that period of time, the 2 years, Commerce would be effectively
assessing. But isn't the point of an expedited review to give the treatment as if they had been individually investigated to those companies? And the treatment, if they had been individually investigated in the investigation, would be exclusion from day one.
I'm not sure if that's the purpose of, I mean, I don't know whether the purpose, as the purpose of the CVDXR review. The CVDXR review says you can request a review 30 days after the final results, the final determination of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, it seems like it's an entirely different proceeding. And Commerce's response to our argument was that they have authority to do this under the investigation statute, which is 1671B. And that is an investigation, and the investigation statute has a whole different timeline established for the investigation, and CBD XR review were outside of that timeline. And I know that the Fed Circuit has said that Commerce does have statutory authority to conduct CBD XR review, but the Fed Circuit relied on the respondent selection provision and not the investigation statute. So we think that, that just because they have the statutory authority to do it, they still have to, you know, tether their practice under the statute.
Okay.
That's my argument.
Ms. Beck, you want to respond to that?
We don't have anything at this time, Your Honor. If the court has questions, we'd be happy to follow up on them.
Okay. Anyone?
Oh, I have to say something, Your Honor. For the record, I'll be brief, but in our response brief, this is the joint brief of the a number of the Canadian parties, we pointed out that the regulation directs Commerce to exclude from affirmative final determination, or an order under Section 706A, any exporter or producer which the Secretary determines an individual's net countervailing subsidy rate of zero or de minimis. And then we go on to talk about, you know, if there's any doubt about Commerce's interpretation of its regulation, the preamble to Section 351.214 provides, quote, because the Department will be reviewing the original period of investigation, we have provided for the exclusion from a CVD order of a firm for which the Secretary determines an individual countervailing duty subsidy rate. No.
I mean, arguably, Ms. Lynn could still make her same point, is that it's not specific as to whether it is intended to be read as exclude from the order prospectively only or back to the original date of suspension of liquidation, right?
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because as a practical matter, then what we would have is the first, you don't even have any rates assessed for this time period from, you know, the 2015 period of investigation. Sorry, that doesn't work. Never mind. I was trying to go to the practical effect of the first administrative review. The companies are not in the order for the first administrative review, so they don't have any duties owed.
But they wouldn't have had a chance to request that first administrative review because of...
Yeah, and even right now, Your Honor, it...
...know if they were going to be out or not.
Right, well, exactly. And even right now, Your Honor, for I think it's AR-6, or maybe it was just AR-5, the companies that had the exclusion reinstated, then Commerce said that they couldn't, you know, initiate on them because they're not in the review. So you're putting these companies in an impossible situation,
mm-hmm.
and that can't be the law. And I don't mean you.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? Nope. All good? All right. Thank you all. Very helpful. Appreciate your efforts and your tracing to New York on Valentine's Day. It did not go without notice by some. I won't specify who, that, you know, it was odd that Valentine's Day was the only day that so many members of the trade bar were available. I hope that we will have concluded this early enough that you can get home to your significant others and enjoy a nice evening. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
All right. The Honorable Court now stands adjourned.